Okay, so let us begin with the homage to the Buddha.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa.
Okay, good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Pandu.
Just about 8 hours ago, I was in San Francisco Airport. Excuse me?
I'm just surprised.
I think I got 20 minutes of sleep this morning in Johnny's car. Oops. And some people have difficulty believing in the Buddha's teaching of rebirth. So at 11, yeah, it was at 2 a.m. American time. I'm sorry, 2 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. I passed away in San Francisco. And at about 7:20 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, I was reborn in New York. Okay, so we are taking today sutta number 39 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Greater Discourse at Asapura, the City of Horses. Okay, and so the sutta begins with the Buddha addressing the monks, calling their attention. And now he's going to explain to them how they fulfill the meaning of the word samana. The word samana. Behave yourself. The words, I say this antenna, this has an antenna.
It looks like it.
Yeah, it seems to amplify the sound. Okay, the word samana is a Pali word which is translated as recluses. Sanskrit form is shramana, and it comes from the root shram, which means to work, to labor. And so even in contemporary Sinhalese language, the language used in Sri Lanka, there's an expression shramadana, which means the gift of work. Instead of giving people money, sometimes people will get together and people from maybe a well-to-do village will help people in a poor village develop their facilities. And so this is called shramadana, the gift of work. And so the word samana originally means someone who is devoted to work or to labor. But what is meant here is not manual work or even office work or work in the computer sector, IT sector, but it's the work of striving, of striving for the development of the mind. And so in the Buddha's time, there was a whole mass of people who had dropped out from the social order with its fixed duties and obligations in order to devote themselves to the work of striving for wisdom, striving for liberation. And these people were called shramanas. And in the Indian religious sector of the time, there were two groups of people. One were the shramanas, and the others were the brahmins or brahmanas. And there were certain differences between these two groups. The brahmanas accepted the authority of the Vedas, the sacred religious scriptures, going back to very early period. The Brahmins generally married and would raise families. And the Brahmins would engage in ritualistic practices. They would serve the royalty. They would also serve ordinary people by performing the fixed rituals of the Vedas for them. And the Brahmins, of course, believed in the caste system or class system. And not only did they believe in it, but they also believed that they were the superior social class and that all the other people came under the Brahmins. So the Brahmins would say that the Brahmin class was created from the mouth of Brahma, the Kshatriyas, that is, the governing class, the administrators, the warriors, were created from the arms of Brahma. The Vaishyas, these would be the business people, the landowners, those who own the fields, they were created from the belly of Brahma and the thighs of Brahma, and the sudras, or lowest class, the workers, the manual workers, were created from the feet of Brahma. Now, in contrast with the Brahmins, the samanas did not accept the authority of the Vedas. In that way, they were a heterodox system. It seems that the samanas might even have been descended from the pre-Aryan religions of India, or at least the idea of renunciation that the samanas embodied. So they didn't accept the Vedas as authoritative. They did not marry and raise families, but they were renunciants who left the household life in order to cultivate a path to liberation. They didn't perform rituals. They left the ritualism to the Brahmins. But their work was the work, basically, of meditation and ascetic practices. And the samanas, of course, they had to function within the social class system, but they didn't accept it as authoritative. And in fact, the samanas were outside the system of the four main social classes. So when one became a samana, one gave up one's status within the class system of Indian society. And one became almost like an outcast. Okay, so now this sutta is about the theme of what makes one a samana, a recluse. But the Buddha also takes the word brahmana or brahman and gives it another meaning almost synonymous with samana. So perhaps the original idea of Brahman was a person who was a kind of vehicle or channel for the sacred power of Brahma. Brahma is the holy divinity of Indian religion. And so the Brahmana was somebody who, in a sense, embodied the spiritual power of Brahma. And so the Buddha takes the word Brahmana or Brahman and gives it a new meaning. It doesn't mean for the Buddha somebody who functions as the ritual specialist in the Indian class system, but somebody who is truly a holy person because of his spiritual development. Okay, so now the Buddha opens by saying, recluses, recluses. This is samana, samana, bhikkhus. That is how people perceive you. And when you are asked, what are you? You claim that you are samanas. Okay, so that is what you are designated. That's what people call you. And that is what you claim to be. When people ask, what are you? You say, we are samanas. You should train in this way. We will undertake and practice those things that make one a recluse, a samana, those things that make one a brahmana. In this way, our designations may be true and our claims genuine, and the services of those whose robes, alms food, resting place, and medicinal requisites we use shall bring them great fruit and benefit, and so that our going forth shall not be vain but fruitful and fertile. See, in this part of the statement, the Buddha is referring to two types of benefits that the samana or ascetic promotes. First, there's the benefit for others, because people make offerings to the Buddhist monks. They make offerings of robes, food, their daily food, their living quarters, whether it be a big hall for the Sangha, or whether it be just a little hut. And they offer them medicines as well when they get ill, or medicines to use in times of illness. And within the Indian frame of reference, including the Buddhist frame of reference, when one makes offerings of gifts to those who are leading a spiritual life, then those offerings become sources of merit or of spiritual virtue, which has the capacity to bring fruits for them in the future, to bring them well-being and happiness. Those gifts are wholesome karma, which will bring benefits to the donors, to the people who provide the offerings. And so when the Buddhist monks, who are called samanas, fulfill their obligations, fulfill their training, then the services or the gifts of the devotees will bring them much benefit, much merit, and much benefits and fruits. And also, by fulfilling these practices, the Buddha says, our going forth will be fruitful and fertile. That is, by fulfilling these practices, one will reach the goal or aim of the spiritual life. That is the achievement of enlightenment, higher knowledge and Nibbana, Nirvana. Okay, so this is the theme with which the Buddha opens the sutta, and now he's going to explain what are the things that make one a samana, what are the things that make one a brahmana. And as usual, the Buddha approaches this in a sequential way, taking it step by step from the simplest, most basic, most obvious, going up to the final goal. Okay, so he says at the outset, so what are the things that make one a recluse, that make one a brahmana? Bhikkhus, you should train thus. We will be possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing. Okay, so this is in a way the starting point of, especially the starting point of moral development or ethical development. And the Buddha here refers to two qualities. Okay, they're translated Hiri is what is translated inadequately as shame and Ottappa as fear of wrongdoing. Now the reason I say that Hiri is inadequately translated as shame is because first the word shame usually means something that, a feeling that comes over one after one does something that one considers to be wrong. But hiri is actually a quality that protects one from doing something wrong. Now there's a difference between hiri and ottappa in what we might call their point of reference. Hiri, the sense of shame, has an internal point of reference. That is, one hesitates to do something which is wrong, one is reluctant to do something that's wrong, one refrains from doing something wrong, because one has what I would call a sense of inner respect for oneself, or what I would call a sense of one's own inner dignity. Maybe we can call this a sense of the potential nobility of one's own character. And so one hesitates to do something which is unwholesome, morally unsuitable, because doing so would detract from this awareness of the potential nobility of one's character. Because doing so would slur one's sense of inner dignity, would be like stooping to do something low, and then one would feel inwardly defiled by that action. One would feel that one is spoiling one's own beauty, of potential beauty of character. So we say that hiri has an internal sense, an internal point of reference, because it stems from the way one evaluates oneself, the way one thinks of oneself. And so one is aware that if I do something which is unwholesome, unsuitable, improper. One will reproach oneself. One will blame oneself. One's mind will be constantly nagged by a sense of conscience, reproaching one for the actions that one has done. Okay, in contrast, Otapa has what I call the external point of reference, since this is fear of the consequences, the undesirable consequences of doing something wrong. So there are different consequences that come from doing what is wrong. One of the most obvious is that other people will find out about it and they'll blame you, criticize you to your face and amongst one another. And then that will cause unpleasant feelings within oneself. You know what happens, like there are famous movie stars or sports stars, and they get caught in the scandal, or politicians for that matter. Like this, I think he was the governor of South Carolina, Sanford, Mark Sanford, is that the name? He said he was going for a long hike on the Appalachian Trail. It was about a year ago, 2 years ago. Passage of time, hard to keep track of. Then it turned out that, you know, in public he was always saying, oh, I love my wife, I'm so devoted to my wife. And of course he aspired to become, I think, the senator from South Carolina and then become candidate for the presidency of the United States. Then somehow it turns out that, you know, he was in Argentina with the woman he calls his soulmate. Whoops. And so once these facts become disclosed, then a big scandal breaks out, and, you know, all over the newspapers, governor of South Carolina found having an adulterous affair. So that's first consequence, big splash in the news. Then he has to, he can't fulfill his bid to become the senator. His hopes of the presidency are dashed to pieces. And his whole life is ruined. Did he resign as, I don't remember, did he resign as a governor? Or maybe he had been the, anybody remember?
He didn't resign.
Excuse me? He didn't resign, he continued as the governor.
A lot of chutzpah.
Yeah, the shame of it. But still, he has the consequences. Okay, so some of the obvious consequences, the ones that are immediately visible, are that one gets subjected to public criticism, public ridicule, one loses one's status in the community, one gets a bad reputation. And then the other major type of consequence is what's called the consequence pertaining to the future life. That is, when one does something immoral or unwholesome, then one creates unwholesome karma, which will bring suffering in the future. Okay, so the Buddha actually refers to these two factors, Hiri and Otapa. He calls them the protectors of the world, since it's these two factors that maintain the moral standards in the world, that keep people committed to fulfill ethical behavior. If people didn't have the sense of shame and fear of the consequences, then their behavior would not be restrained at all. Okay, so the starting point for the Buddha in this whole training, and this is valid for whether it be monastic person or lay person, but the foundation is the sense of shame, or I would call it the sense of inner dignity, of self-respect, and fear of wrongdoing, fear of the consequences. Then the Buddha continues. He says to the monks, you may think thus. We are possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing. That much is enough. That much has been done. Our goal, the goal of the ascetic life, has been reached. There is nothing more for us to do. And you may rest content with that much. So some monks obviously think in that way, but then the Buddha says, I inform you, I declare to you, you who seek the status of a recluse, of a true ascetic, do not fall short of the goal of recluseship, the goal of the spiritual life. While there is more to be done, then he raises the question, and what more is to be done? You should train in this way. Our bodily conduct shall be purified, clear and open, flawless and restrained, and we will not laud ourselves, praise ourselves, and disparage others on account of that purified bodily conduct. So you see, the Buddha here, he's balancing two important factors. First is to observe pure conduct of body. And then some of the factors that constitute purified bodily conduct, you will find, for example, in Sutta number 27 of the Majjhima Nikaya. This would be on page 272 in the text. I'm not going to read in detail, but just some of the factors are to abstain from killing living beings and to be compassionate to all living beings, to abstain from stealing, and to take only what is given, to abide in purity and honesty, to abstain from incelibacy, and to observe celibacy. That is for the monastic person. Okay, so one aspect of this is to be oneself well-established in pure bodily conduct, but that is balanced against the second aspect, which is to maintain an attitude of humility in relationship to others. That is, one doesn't praise oneself, extol oneself, or even one doesn't even feel self-satisfied that I'm a pure person, I'm a righteous person, I'm a good person. And then one looks at others who are not observing pure bodily conduct and think they are wretches, they are sinners, they are evildoers, they are immoral, useless, worthless fellows. But instead one will just simply have compassion for them, and to the extent that one can, one might try to help them by teaching them how to observe pure bodily conduct. Okay, so then the Buddha continues, you may think, thus we are possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing, and our bodily conduct has been purified. That much is enough. That much has been done. The goal has been reached. Okay, but then the Buddha says, I inform you, I declare to you, do not fall short of the goal of the spiritual life while there is still more to be done. Okay, what more is to be done? Next, our verbal conduct shall be purified. Then we find purified verbal conduct, again on same page. To abstain from false speech, actually page 273, to abstain from false speech and to speak the truth, to abstain from malicious speech and to speak in ways that promote harmony, to abstain from harsh speech, and to speak softly and gently, and to abstain from gossip, and to speak what is meaningful, to speak what is factual, to speak about what is good, and so on. Okay, so paragraph 4-5 deals with proper verbal conduct. Paragraph 6 deals with proper mental conduct, not to think unwholesome thoughts. And paragraph 7 deals with right livelihood. So all of these are explained in the same way. In each case, one fulfills that factor flawlessly, clearly, openly, and one doesn't praise oneself either verbally or in one's own thoughts and disparage others who do not fulfill that factor. Okay, so now coming to paragraph 8, the Buddha is now going to take the training one step further. He says, "What more is to be done? You should train thus. We will guard the doors of our sense faculties." So this is what is called the training in restraint of the senses. On seeing a form with the eye, we will not grasp at its signs and features, since if we left the eye faculty unguarded, then evil or bad, unwholesome mental states, states of greed and states of disappointment or dejection might overcome us. So to avoid this, we should practice the restraint over the sense faculty. We should guard the eye faculty. We should undertake the restraint of the eye faculty. Okay, so this is an important part of the training for the higher practice of meditation, because the practice of meditation is ultimately directed to overcoming the hindrances of the mind. And so what are the hindrances, the main hindrances? Some of our veterans?
Ill will, sloth, torpor.
Let's start from the beginning. You have to get the right order.
Sensualness.
Yeah, I can't expect that from you.
Sensual lust.
Okay, sensual lust. Next. Ill will.
Now it's sloth.
Yeah.
Okay. Sloth.
Restlessness.
We call it sloth. Usually they say sloth and torpor.
Sloth and torpor.
Or dullness and drowsiness. Yeah. The next.
Restlessness.
Yeah, restlessness and remorse. And the fifth is?
Doubt.
Doubt. Okay. You see, they got it in the right order. So why turn your eye? You're rolling your eyes. Yeah, you have to get the right order.
But you are restless. Well, you didn't get enough rest.
You can be crabby one of them.
I will get it. After class, I will go to sleep and set the alarm clock for Tuesday morning. Oops, sloth and torpor.
Yes, it was good.
Okay, so of the five hindrances, the two that are the grossest, the ones that arise most often, the most obstructive, are sensual desire and ill will or anger. Okay, and those arise, well, actually all of them arise through the impact of the senses, the input of the senses, but especially when there is a pleasant or an agreeable visible form, sound, or so on, then the mind goes out to it and becomes attracted to it. And if there's something which is repulsive, disagreeable, then it will cause inner aversion, displeasure, dejection, anger. And so the hindrances are continually being stimulated or provoked by the input of the senses. But what can one do? One solution is to put a blindfold over the eyes, put the earplugs into the ear, and then one doesn't see anything disagreeable, doesn't hear anything disagreeable. But it's pretty difficult to live under those conditions. And so what the Buddha teaches is this restraint of the senses, and that is elaborated as one does not grasp at what is called the sign, and one does not grasp at the features. Here we have two terms. I was just thinking, when I go back to my room, then I'll fall into a deep sleep that's surrendering to sloth. Then after waking up, then I have to check my emails, which have been accumulating over the past 10 days or so, and that will cause a lot of restlessness. Okay, so what is meant by sign, the Pali word is nimitta. This is explained as the general feature of the object. And so when the sense faculties say this, I will immediately pick up on whether there's an agreeable form or a disagreeable form. And so that immediate impact of agreeable form, that is the nimitta, the general feature of the object. And usually when the commentaries are explaining this, of course they're explaining it for monks, and so they usually, please excuse me, use the primary object of temptation for the monk. So that would be the form of the beautiful woman. So the nimitta will be picking up the form beautiful woman, at least in one example. Then the anubhyanjana means the more specific features. And so once the mind sort of becomes drawn towards the sign, the general feature, then it starts looking at the details. You know, nice hair, wavy hair or straight hair, black hair, blonde hair, curly hair, whatever, brown hair, I don't want that, gray hair, blue hair. Blue hair. The nice smile, shiny eyes. Okay, so those are the features. And then also sometimes it happens with the repugnant object, disagreeable object. You know, if like there's a person you dislike, first you see that person, you know, I don't like Jake. So then Jake comes into the room, immediately I see him, disagreeable feeling comes up. But then I start focusing on everything he's doing, the way he walks. Why can't he just walk softly like everybody else? Why is he always stamping his feet? Why can't he sit quietly in his seat instead of just plopping in his seat like that? Why does his voice always sound rasping instead of soft and gentle like Bhante's voice? Okay, so this is, those are the features, specific features. And so this doesn't mean when one practices restraint of the senses, it doesn't mean that one closes the eyes, blocks the ears, and tries to avoid the sensory world. But one exercises restraint of the senses by not grasping at the signs. I mean, one will see whatever appears in the field of vision, but one doesn't let the eye get drawn to what's pleasant. You know, like if you go shopping, you go into the shopping district. I was just thinking, in San Francisco, we took a little trip to the, we didn't really want to go to the shopping district, but that just to get the streetcar to go up to go up the hill traveling in the cable car, but we had to pass through the shopping district. And nothing in the shopping district attracts me, but the two women that I were with. Then I went back early, they came back late. I asked, why do you get back so late? Oh, we passed through the shopping district. So you start looking in the shops. What's for sale in this shop? What's for sale in that shop? So that's grasping at the signs. Then grasping at the features. Oh, what a nice dress for sale. Or what nice shirt for sale. Or wow, new iPods are out, or iPads. The one that I bought last year, now out of style, new ones are coming out. Okay, so one practices this restraint of the senses with regard to all of the senses, even with the thoughts that come into the mind, this is practicing restraint over the mind faculty. So sometimes, you know, thoughts just come flowing into the mind, memories of pleasant objects, memories of unpleasant objects, plans and visions for the future, regrets about the past. So, of course, they flow naturally into the mind, but when one is practicing restraint of the senses, one doesn't let the mind linger with them, but just notes whatever arises and just let it go its own way. Okay, so now the Buddha, in this way, he's explaining restraint of the senses. Now we're moving from conduct. See, conduct deals with the more external aspect of life, bodily and verbal conduct and the right livelihood. But now we're dealing with the inner thought processes, the way the mind functions in relation to the senses. So this is preparing the way, I would say it's paving the way towards the inner cultivation aimed at samadhi or meditative concentration. Okay, now we move on to the next phase of the training, which really goes along pretty much with restraint of the senses. They're actually virtually synonymous, they work together, so we can't force a division between them. Yes?
Yeah, I'm puzzled by grief. evil, unwholesome state of covetousness and grief.
I think actually grief is not really I think it's not a good translation here. The Pali word is dominasa, which means literally it's a bad state of mind. So somanasa is happiness. So dominasa would be something like sadness or sorrow or displeasure. And when it's paired with covetousness, so what's meant by covetousness is craving, a greedy desire, then dominasa would be the opposite of that. It would be a kind of displeasure or dejection that arises because of an unskillful way of attending to a disagreeable object.
Repulsion, aversion?
Yeah, those could be also included under dominasa. Yeah, I think maybe Venerable Nyanamoli, or maybe it was myself, picked up grief from earlier translators, but I stopped using it in the connected discourses. I think I had, in the connected discourses, I used displeasure.
The grief could imply sorrow for loss. Say that if a monk has given up something, you may feel that seeing something he would covet, he could feel grief or loss for having given it up.
I don't really think that is so much intended.
I would think that aversion or repulsion would be better.
Yeah, they seem to be better and they fit the context better. Okay, so then we'll move on to moderation and eating. So as I said, this goes closely together with restraint of the senses, particularly restraint of the tongue. So this is, you see, a problem that happens in the monastic life is that since one doesn't have much input from the other senses, so for somebody who has a natural tendency to greed or to sensual enjoyment, the life revolves around the meal of the day. And so people sometimes, monks, maybe nuns too, I don't know, but I never discussed the issue with them, but I know that for some monks, the whole life will revolve around having delicious meal. And sometimes, because it's considered meritorious to offer delicious food to monastics, people will prepare very sumptuous food and offer them. And so they can tend to overeat and develop this, because if they have this greed for taste, then one indulges oneself and then one can overeat. And if one overeats, then, well, that can induce at least one of the five hindrances. What hindrance?
Sloth.
Yeah, sloth and torpor. Dullness and drowsiness, and also the craving for food will be a kind of sensual desire.
I was going to say that would be the first thought, sensual desire.
Yeah, yeah. And then if one has a craving, also a craving for delicious food, sometimes if one goes to an alms round and one comes maybe to families that are not well off, they'll just offer very simple food. And then the person who has been dreaming about, a delicious hillside rice with many sumptuous curries and side dishes, maybe a nice dessert of buffalo curd with palm tree honey. What's so funny? It's something very delicious that's served in South Asia. They take the milk from the buffalo, the water buffalo, and they turn it into a yogurt, except that it's thicker than the ordinary yogurt. And then there's a kind of honey that comes from a type of palm tree, which is very sweet, and pour this honey, palm honey, it's almost like maple syrup, pour it in over the buffalo curd and mix together, and it's like considered the royal treat in South Asia, Sri Lanka, India. And then nowadays, the royal treat has become ice cream. Okay, so if one is dreaming of having the buffalo curd and the ice cream and the sweets, the fruits, then one just gets, you know, some very plain rice, maybe a couple of spoons of lentils, dal over it, and that's it. Then one grumbles and inwardly complains, and one feels self-pity. Oh, I'm starving to death. How am I going to get through the day on this? Okay, so the Buddha teaches that one should do this reflection over the food to remind oneself of the purpose of eating. So you should train thus. We will be moderate in eating, reflecting wisely. We will take food neither for amusement nor for intoxication. Here, intoxication doesn't mean getting drunk, but it means being intoxicated with the flavor of the food. So neither for amusement nor for intoxication, nor for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness. But only for the endurance and continuance of this body, for sustaining the body, for ending discomfort, the discomfort of hunger, and for assisting or supporting the spiritual life. Considering, thus I shall terminate old feelings, that is the old feeling or discomfort of hunger, without arousing new feelings that could be feelings of discomfort because of having eaten too much. And I shall be healthy and blameless and live in comfort. Maybe better to live at ease, since one is free from the discomfort of being hungry, the pangs of hunger. Okay, so this is the way one practices moderation in eating. Of course, not only does one reflect in this way, but also when one takes the food, one has to be moderate in the quantities one takes. So it's usually advised not to eat until one's stomach is full, but to eat about 3/4 of the capacity, and then to drink water. And if you think that you have the habit of eating too much and it's a kind of habitual addiction, try just eating 3/4 of your normal capacity and do it regularly. And after a while, you find that you become accustomed to that 3/4. Then you can go down another step to 3/4 of that 3/4. And that should be enough. You don't have to go below that. But also get exercise. Don't be lazy. It's important to get exercise. Otherwise, even if one doesn't eat much, one starts to gain weight. Okay, so now the Buddha says, you may think we are possessed of shame and fear of wrongdoing, our bodily, verbal, mental conduct, and our livelihood have been purified. We guard the doors of the sense faculties and we are moderate in eating. That much is enough, and you may rest content with that much. But I inform you, I declare to you, you who seek the status of a true ascetic, don't fall short of the goal of the ascetic or the renunciate life, while there is still more to be done. Maybe at this point I'll ask whether any questions on what has come up so far.
You were saying it's important to have the hindrances in order.
Yeah.
Why is there a reason or...
I just want to...
Beyond an intellectual...
It's not really essential, but I just like the students to learn the hindrances in the proper sequence. It shows that they've been attending to the text and not just trying to fish back into the... into the lake of memory. Yes, please.
You were saying not to cover the eye. You can't cover your eyes or cover your ears and block out the world. But in a retreat, one does that in a sense of a retreat that's happening here, where you aren't seeing things and you aren't hearing things. And there's a place for that, isn't there? And,
what I meant by blocking the eyes is, actually covering up the eyes that one doesn't have any sensory input at all. But what the Buddha actually teaches for the monastics, or even for those in diligent training, is, of course, one keeps the eyes open, but one just looks, generally, one just looks in front of oneself about 5 meters, 3 to 5 meters ahead of one, unless there's some reason to look up or to look around. And so in this way, if one is just looking around at random, then one tends to pick up sensory input, which could provoke either sensual desire or ill will. But if one keeps the senses under restraint, then one just looks, 5 meters ahead of one. Then one is just picking up the sensory impressions in the immediate environment. As far as the ear goes, one can't really control the range of the ear as to what one hears, but if one is going to go into a meditation retreat, it will be usually a quiet place so that the hearing isn't bombarded with loud and disturbing sounds, and then one could focus more easily on the meditation.
Can one overdo that and then have a hard time getting back into the noisy world again?
I don't think one could overdo it, because the quiet itself is beneficial for the meditation, but it sometimes takes a little period to readjust to getting back into the world. So maybe that's why often in meditation retreats on the last day or sometimes the last 2 days, they'll allow the meditators to start talking to one another. And that way they'll get used to interacting with people and picking up on the sense impressions that come from human contacts. But I wanted to add, sometimes it's after one gets some experience in meditation, sometimes it's good to choose a place which is not completely silent for the meditation, so that one learns how to deal with sounds. It shouldn't be a place where there's like a rock band playing the next building. You shouldn't be maybe practicing meditation outside Madison Square Garden, while there's a Rolling Stones concert going on. I reveal the extent of my knowledge of the rock world. What are the latest bands?
Well, the latest now, because I'm sort of back in the dinosaur.
You're a dinosaur. Okay, we're all dinosaurs. But sometimes a certain amount of normal sound, like cars going by outside, occasionally people walking by talking, is useful so that one can practice dealing with sounds that might otherwise be distracting. Yes?
I want to know how the feelings of instinct and intuition come into, you talk about seeing Jake and not liking the way he does this. In some way, though, instinct and intuition are survival.
Yeah.
I mean, you're walking in a dangerous place and your instinct says something.
No, of course one has to protect oneself from obvious dangers.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's hard to make.
No, it's not so difficult. Well, basically, just what one has to do is it's really a matter of protecting the mind from giving rise to states of aversion, repulsion, dislike, anger, ill will.
Yeah.
But if one is in a dangerous situation, one has to be prudent in avoiding the dangers.
So all just gets tempered, really.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, there's Sutta number 2, the Sabbasava Sutta, where the Buddha speaks about, he's giving the advice to the monks, and he speaks about advising a wild bull, a wild horse, a wild, a mad dog, a dangerous dog. So one has to protect oneself from dangers.
And yet, show compassion?
You mean towards the wild bull, the wild dog?
Yeah. I don't know.
One can have compassion in the mind, but one doesn't stand there if the wild bull is going to come.
Totally move away. But
yeah.
I work in a mental hospital.
Yeah.
Some of the stuff.
Yeah. Anyway, this is a kind of sense training. Yeah. It's not dealing with everyday life and all of one's involvements in everyday life, but this is the way to train the senses in order to prepare the mind for going deeper in the meditation.
Okay. Sorry, I got off the track.
Okay, so let's come to the next factor, and this is called wakefulness. Now we actually come into the direct practice of meditation. So what's called wakefulness here is explained, the Buddha will explain, during the day, while walking back and forth and sitting, we will purify our minds of obstructive states. So here he's describing a monastic person who's engaged in full-time meditation. And so during the day, the monk or nun will be alternating periods of sitting meditation and walking meditation. This is called Chakmana Bhavana, Chakman Bhavana, the meditation while walking back and forth. So in sitting, it could be mindfulness of the breathing, loving kindness meditation, any suitable meditation subject. And when walking back and forth, one will simply be mindful of walking, or right step, left, right, left, or lifting, pushing, putting down, pressing. And in this way, one is purifying the mind of the obstructive states, that would be of the five hindrances. So any hindrance arises, one just dispels it, lets it go, and brings the mind back to the meditation subject. Then in the first watch of the night, again, one practices walking back and forth and sitting and purifies the mind of obstructive states. But then in the middle watch of the night, we will lie down on the right side in the lion's pose with one foot overlapping the other, mindful and fully aware, after noting in our minds the time for arising. Exactly what is meant by the first, middle, and last watches of the night, since in the Buddha's time they didn't have clocks. So I don't know exactly how to put them in terms of our clock time, but I would say roughly, let's say the first watch of the night might be from 6 p.m. till 10 p.m. Middle watch could be from 10 p.m. to 3 a.m. Then the last watch from 3 a.m. to maybe 3 a.m. to 6 a.m. So the middle watch of the night, one can sleep for 5 hours, but if one is practicing meditation very diligently, the need for sleep will start to diminish till one could sleep quite comfortably, satisfactorily, with 4 hours or even 3 hours of sleep, because the mind is becoming restful through the practice of meditation. Okay, so then after rising, then in what we would call the very early morning, maybe 3 a.m., continuing until 6, 7 a.m., again one practices meditation, sitting, walking back and forth, sitting. Okay, so then the Buddha says, you may, after doing all of this, you may think that you are doing enough, but again the Buddha urges the monks not to fall short of the goal of recluseship while there is more to be done. And then he explains what is more to be done, and this is called mindfulness and full awareness. Well, now I would actually render the Pali word sampajanya, clear comprehension. In Pali, the word rendered as mindfulness is sati, and the word rendered here, full awareness or clear comprehension, is sampajanya. These two factors work very, very closely together, and so it's somewhat difficult to distinguish their exact functions. But the way I understand them, mindfulness is, I call this an awareness. It's a little misleading because Jnanamoli rendered sampajanya as full awareness. But I take mindfulness to be the presence of mind, or clear awareness in the sense of a very simple, basic awareness. Whereas sampajanya, I render clear comprehension because it involves an element of knowing or is distinguishing. And the word sampajanya comes from the root nya, which means to know, knowledge. And then it has two prefixes, sam, which gives a sense of fullness, and pa, which gives a sense of activity. It's a kind of full, active knowing of, in this case, what one is doing and what one is experiencing. So sati, or mindfulness, is that factor that makes the experience, the activity, present to the mind. And then sampajanya, clear comprehension, is what discerns, distinguishes, knows what one is doing. And so the Buddha uses these two terms, usually he applies them to the various activities, the little activities of everyday life. So when one leaves the meditation cushion or the meditation hall to engage in other activities, one doesn't let the mind just slip into carelessness, or into, one doesn't let the mind drift, roam and wander, but one remains fully present with what one is doing, and one distinguishes clearly what one is doing. So remaining present with what one is doing, that is mindfulness, and distinguishing clearly what one is doing is sampajanya, clear comprehension. So the text says, I'm going to change the translation, we will act with clear comprehension when going forward and returning, when going out and coming back. We will act with clear comprehension when looking ahead and looking to the side. We will act it with clear comprehension, when flexing and extending our limbs, when bending and stretching out the arms, the legs. We will act with clear comprehension when putting on our robes, wearing the robes, and carrying the extra robe and bowl. We will act in clear comprehension when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting. So even when putting the food into the mouth, chewing it, swallowing it, one is aware of what one is doing. You know, so usually, this is quite normal, don't think one shouldn't do this, but when people sit at the table taking a meal, you know, they chat and their minds are on the subject of the conversation, and just occasionally they'll be just vaguely aware of taking up the spoon, putting it in the mouth and chewing the food, tasting it, and then immediately back to the conversation. Did you hear what Jimmy did the other day? So what did he do? It's shocking, isn't it? How interesting. But instead, when trying to maintain the continuity of mindfulness, of the meditative mind, then when one is taking the food, you know, picking it up with a spoon, one knows what one is doing, putting it in the mouth, one is aware of putting it in the mouth, when chewing it, one is doing that with mindfulness and clear understanding. When swallowing the food, when experiencing the taste, one experiences the taste mindfully with clear understanding. When one swallows the food, again with mindfulness and clear understanding. And so every step or every phase in the act of eating is done with mindfulness and clear comprehension. Okay. We will act in full awareness when defecating and urinating. So even when going to the toilet, one knows what one is doing. We will act in full awareness when walking. These are just the little postures. When walking, standing still, sitting down, falling asleep, except in the back of Johnny's car, waking up, talking, and keeping silent. Okay, so in all the activities, one maintains the mindfulness and clear comprehension. And so you can see that the sequence now is building up step by step into the attainment of the higher stages of meditation and the insight knowledges. But we will deal with that in the next class. Yeah, that will be next week. So, maybe any questions on... yes, Bowie.
Can we say, as long as one has clear comprehension, that person has mindfulness simultaneously, but if one has Mindfulness, that doesn't mean he has clear comprehension.
Okay, the question is, can we say that when a person has clear comprehension, they necessarily have mindfulness simultaneously? But when there's mindfulness, there's not necessarily clear comprehension. It seems in theory that that should be possible, but I don't know any texts which speak about this possibility. The texts always speak about developing mindfulness and clear comprehension simultaneously. But actually, the case that you brought up is actually, I think, possible. You could take a case maybe of a person who might be walking, maybe walking very mindfully, in a sense, he's aware of taking right step, left step, right step, left step, right step, boom, falls into a ditch, because he wasn't clearly comprehending where he was walking. So to have clear comprehension, to have clear comprehension when one is walking, one also has to be aware, not just of each step, not just to have the act of walking present, but one has to be aware of the environment in which one is walking. So that I would say, is an aspect of clear comprehension. Yes?
I thought next week we were doing the Sutta 41 in conjunction with the Dharma training course. Is that next week?
Did I say that?
Yeah. Well, the photocopies of Sutta 41 were passed out last week to the Dharma training course.
Really?
Yeah.
Insane.
Because I would have expected that Sutta 39 would take two classes.
That's on the schedule.
But we'll provide the 39 for the class. That was the schedule said that we were going to do 41 next week. But that's all right, no problem.
My schedule.
Yes.
The schedule on the website says our
schedule
39
on the website. But there's been a change on the schedule. There's a couple of classes that were.
Yeah, maybe because I missed.
Yes, I think that's why.
Yeah, because I know Sutta 39 is difficult, virtually impossible to do in one class.
One of your many emails you'll see is one from me asking you what Sutta we're talking.
Oh, maybe because I was expecting to finish Sutta 39 today.
Yes.
And so then I would have expected 41.
Yes.
But I think, anyway, the second half of 39 is almost intelligible on its own. And I'm going to recapitulate just, in 5 minutes what's covered in the first part of 39. So the class will be able to follow next week anyway. So don't worry that they're picking up in the middle of the sutta. Okay, we can go up and take.
My question is, Sampanjana, clear comprehension in conflict with guarding the senses and not to grasp onto distant futures and form.
Does clear comprehension conflict with
guarding the senses and not to grasp onto distinct futures and form?
I don't see why it should conflict. Of course it doesn't conflict, because it's part of the same training. Okay, I think we'll have to stop now. Stop now. Then we can take the lunch now and then come back. Oh, because they're having the course, probably they're not opening the dining room to the public until 12 o'clock. How to do?
May I suggest Bande get some more rest?
Discussion next week.
Okay, we can have the discussion period next week. Okay, thank you. Okay, so we'll end with the sharing of the merits. So we share the merits with the devas, the buddhas, the dragon spirits, and other beings, wishing them all to be well and happy, and to protect the Buddha's teachings. Akasata chumata deva naga mahitika punyanta nanumodiva shirang rakantu sasana akasata chumata deva naga mahitika punyanta nanumodiva shirang rakantu desana akasata chumata deva naga mahitika punyanta nanumodiva shirang rakantu mangparam etavata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabbe bhutanumodantu sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya bhava upadaya vichihetato etantare satakai upapanna rupiya rupicha sanya sanino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibbuddhiṃ. Okay, we could end with three bows to the Buddha. Okay, actually, those are just accidental hits due to lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension.
Bow to Bandai.